Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Yesterday, the Human Rights Commission, or Suhakam as we call it, presented its report on an 18-month inquiry into a series of missing persons cases. This involved Amri Chetmat, Pastor Raymond Cole, because the two well-known names in this inquiry. Tonight, we speak to Suhakam Commissioner Ma Weng Kwai, who chaired the inquiry, along with Professor Dr. Aisha Bidin and Dr. Nick Salida Suhaila Binti Nick Saleh. They were a three-member panel. Thank you so much, Weng Kwai, for being here. I want to begin with the thing that is in the media a lot, hearsay, that somehow Suhakam has come to the stunning conclusion based on hearsay. Could you explain to us why you think that has become the frame in which your inquiry has been sort of projected in the media?
Yeah, thank you very much, Sharad. Thanks for having me. I think to answer that question, I want to make a distinction right from the very beginning between what is a criminal trial, a civil trial, an inquest, and an inquiry such as this. Now, in a criminal trial, obviously somebody is going to stand trial. There'll be somebody in the dock. And you talk about standard of proof and burden of proof. And in a criminal trial, the standard of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. In a civil case, the standard of proof is on a balanced probabilities. Now, as far as inquests are concerned, which is the inquiry into deaths held by a coroner, the test is on a balance of probabilities. Similarly here, when we were having our inquiry, the test that we applied was on a balance of probabilities, which means to say the evidence is that it is more probable than not to be true, rather than being beyond reasonable doubt.
Okay, so you say on balance of probabilities, Amri Chetmat, for instance, was abducted by state agents, namely the Special Branch. So you've actually named an organization, not individuals. What is the status of a conclusion like that? You know, it'd be unusual, say, for instance, to hear this in a criminal court. As you say, somebody's in the dock. Here, nobody's in the dock. It's an organization, though, that has been named. Why did you come to that conclusion?
Right. Our inquiry, as you may know, stretched over a period of almost 18 months. And we had, in Amri's case, a total of 20-plus witnesses and 20 over days of hearing. And during this inquiry, we obviously paid a lot of attention to people who came forward to give us the evidence, because the whole inquiry is based on evidence. And in terms of law, it will either be direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. Indirect means circumstantial evidence. And the question here is whether there was sufficient evidence for us to make particular findings. And so it was a question of evaluation of the evidence that we had. And in Amri's case in particular, yes, there's been talk about hearsay evidence and so on. Now, this is not something that was not noticed or was not considered. It was very much in the forefront of our discussions. We realized that quite a bit of the evidence would be was hearsay evidence. But in terms of the law, when we have an inquiry under this Act, under Suhakam Act, Section 14 allows us a little more latitude. We are not constrained by the law under the Evidence Act.
Is that okay? So is that productive? I mean, why has the law given Suhakam that kind of latitude? Is it because of the nature of what you're looking at?
Precisely, because in a case of enforced disappearance, it's always a case of a lot of concealment, and you cannot have it's not easy to just get direct evidence of people coming forward and say, look, this is exactly what happened, because here we're talking about not just an ordinary disappearance, because our finding is clearly it is not a case of voluntary disappearance, neither was it a case of involuntary disappearance under the ordinary criminal law. We are talking about enforced disappearance, where the unseen hand of the state or agents of the state is involved. And we are guided by Article 2, the definition of enforced disappearance under Article 2 of the Convention Against Enforced Disappearance of Persons.
Now, I want to ask you, you know, there are people who are coming out and defending the police, defending the special branch. They feel that this is a taint on them that's unfair, and so on and so forth. I mean, this broad, characterization of the crime that's happened as being one perpetrated by the special branch, is that fair when nobody's named and there's no specific evidence, naming individuals within the special branch of having done so?
Well, we have gone strictly by the evidence, and we were informed that the special branch was involved. So I don't know whether you say we should be naming individuals or not, but anyone reading the report, and it's a very long report, almost 100 pages, and you read between the lines, you will know who are the people that did whatever they did leading up to this event. Because it didn't in Amri's case, for example, things didn't happen overnight. There was a history of surveillance by the religious authorities and by special branch. And right up to the time when, before he was taken on the 24th of November 2016, 3 days of surveillance by three different people in three different cars. And so quite obviously he was under the radar. And this is telling us about the evidence that led up to this situation.
Right. What, in a normal criminal case, I guess you'd also want to ask for motivation, right? That'd be, why was the act perpetrated? Is that something that Suha Kam has any sense of? The purpose, why would state actors or agencies of people in authority want to disappear these two individuals?
There were serious concerns about religious issues. And Amri is a Shia, and that is against the mainstream of Islam in Malaysia. And he was active through his NGO, known as Perlis Hope. And he had been spoken to a few times by the religious authorities. And this was all a couple of years before the actual disappearance in 2016. For Raymond Koh, similarly, he was an evangelical pastor. And his story goes back even further in 2012, when he held a Thanksgiving dinner at DUMC in Petaling Jaya. And the religious authorities came to know of it, and they went to the church, and they found that there were Muslims who were present. So that was an issue of concern, quite obviously. Yeah.
Right. You left the judicial service. You served in the judiciary as a magistrate and then finally the Court of Appeal until you retired in 2015. Does any of this surprise you? You've done criminal cases. Does any of this surprise you?
Well, I was in the judicial and legal service for a good 12 years when I was much younger. And then when I resigned in 85, I came out to practice and was in practice for 25 years before joining the High Court. And I retired from the Court of Appeal in 2015. In my practice, or rather even the early days when I was a prosecutor, obviously we were prosecuting a lot of criminal cases. And as counsel, I was also defending many criminal cases. And all my years, we have always had cases of abduction, kidnap, murder, ISA, the lot. But I never came across a case of enforced disappearance. And this is something which happened very recently. And what is really striking is that within a time span of 3 months, we had three different cases involving four people who have just disappeared and nobody knows where they are.
Right. We'll be back. We'll take a short break. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Dato' Mawing Kwai, who's Suha Kam Commissioner. He was the chair of the inquiry into the disappearance of Amri Chetmat and Pastor Raymond Koh. Two individuals, part of actually a group, four altogether, as you were saying, Kwai, Towards the end of 2016, the early part of 2017, these individuals went missing. Now, one of the issues has become in the media the responsibility, especially the who headed special branch at that time. And Tan Sri Mohammad Fauzi Harun, who's now the Inspector General of Police, is the man who's been named. And so there have been many responses, including one from the Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, saying that perhaps he should be allowed to retire. And then an independent inquiry be launched. Are you surprised by the response of government at this point in time to the work that Suhakam has done and to the conclusion that you've come to?
Well, I am not terribly surprised because the report is pretty strong in its terms, and the conclusion, of course, is very strong. To elicit a response like this, to say we need, Prime Minister did say we need proof, we need evidence. But that's exactly what we have been doing for the last 18 months, to gather the proof, gather the evidence. And I would say it's all there in the report, which is available to anyone who bothers, who wants to read it.
Was the government of the day, and I know this of course happened under Barrister National Watch, but your inquiry has been going on for 18 months now, predating this new government, but also including the government. Did they have representatives? The IGP claims that he too needs to read the report. Didn't the police have a representative at these inquiries?
Yes.
Shouldn't they have been all briefed about the proceedings and the developments at the inquiry?
Absolutely, Sharad. We announced the formation of the panel, and we started our inquiries, the hearings in October 2017. And before we started, we invited the lawyers for the family, lawyers from Bar Council, officers from Suhakam itself, and officers from the police force. And it was a public hearing, open to the public, and we had many, many observers from the various NGOs, individuals even, who came. But then, of course, as time went on, you won't get the same people who was going to be sitting throughout the hearings. But people from the lawyers from the family, Bar Council, Suhakam, and the police, these were the four key bodies that were there throughout. So we had very senior police officers, legally qualified police officers, who came and represented the police. And at every turn, every witness, every opportunity was given to anyone who wanted to ask questions. And I can proudly say we never stopped anyone, provided, of course, the questions were relevant. And everybody went about their job very professionally.
So it should be of no surprise to the police force that you've come to these conclusions, or that any of this has transpired, at least in terms of evidence. I want to ask you about Sergeant Shansani.
Can I just add to that?
Okay.
It's just that after we concluded hearing the oral evidence from witnesses, obviously we had to give time to the lawyers to prepare their written submissions. And that was done sometime in December last year, early January. And this is where all the lawyers had to put their heads together and come up with their written submissions, including the police. So, and there was an exchange of all these submissions. So nobody can say, I did not know what the other guy was submitting on. So, all the submissions by the lawyers were clearly saying that this was a case of enforced disappearance. So,
right. So the IGP's, Fauzi Harun's statement that he needs to read the report.
Fine.
It's fine that he needs, but it's not like the police weren't in fact part of this process. They were part of the process.
From day one.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about Sergeant Shamsani. He's a character in the story because he's a member of the special branch. He played a very crucial role in shaping the Suhakam inquiry. Tell us about that.
Sergeant Shamsani is a officer with a special branch in Kanga, in Perlis. And nobody heard of him or knew of him. But sometime in May 2018, he actually went to see Nor Hayati, who is the wife of Amir Chipmat.
This was the middle of the inquiry. It already started.
We were halfway through the inquiry. And he came along and had a conversation with her middle of the night, 10 o'clock, for almost 2 hours. And according to Nor Hayati, she says that here is this man who wanted to come and tell her all that had happened to her husband. Right? She spoke to him at length, and after the conversation, she immediately informed two of Amri's friends of what transpired, and she made notes in a notebook of what was said. So all this was contemporaneous evidence. Then she lodged a police report 3 days later for the record. But in the meantime, when Sergeant Samzani knew about this report, he was called up to meet his senior officers, and then he himself lodged a police report. And then in that report, he says, "Look, I never said those things." He doesn't deny meeting her, though. He admits going to the house, but he says he went there for an entirely different purpose, and it was to ask her whether the premises adjacent to her house, which belonged to her, whether that those premises were available for rental, as he wanted to do business for a car accessory business. But that particular premises was already rented out to a guy called Farid, and he had a long lease, 25 years or something like that, and was ongoing. Business was ongoing. So
he denies the story that Amri Chetmat's wife then expresses or reveals. I mean, the information that she had coming from Sergeant Shamsani, was it material? Were these things that were not known about what had happened?
Well, he mentioned quite a few things which were already known earlier on during the inquiry. But what was really very, very important was that in what he told Nur Hayati was that he says it was the special branch Bukit Aman that took Amri, and was the same group that took Pastor Koh.
Right, and tying the two cases together.
Yes. Yes.
Right, he's since denied saying this. Is that the point?
Yes, when he came and gave evidence, he said, "Look, I only went there to talk about rental."
Okay.
Nothing of this sort.
I wonder how opaque is the special branch? How opaque are our security services? What kind of, are they in some sense above the law? I mean, your experience as a magistrate and a judge and so on, is this something that you would say, well, makes sense or doesn't make sense? Is it plausible that the special branch should act outside the law, as it were?
My starting point to that, Sharad, will be no one is above the law. Right? We have the Constitution, we have our laws, and most certainly we have the rule of law. Sure, a special branch works in such a way, and that's why they're called special branch, and that they have their own powers, and a lot of it is through intelligence gathering and so on. Things that you and I would probably never see or hear about on a daily basis. It's not like the CID investigating a theft case, you know. So a lot of it is undercover. But here I think the concern was about what we were told was a concern about national security, threats to national security. There was this thought, this perceived idea that because Amri and Raymond, they were having issues with religious concerns, that this was somehow raising a threat to national security. But this was never really explained and never spelled out what kind of threat. What was the real security? Was it imminent? Is it grave and sudden? We don't know.
And certainly their disappearance, enforced or otherwise, is beyond the law as well. We'll take a short break and we'll be back. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Commissioner from Suakam, Amawi Nkwai. He was the chair of the panel of inquiry into the disappearance of Amri Chetmat and Pastor Raymond Koh. He, along with Professor Dr. Aisha Bidin and Dr. Nick Salida Suhaila, led this 18-month inquiry. We've come to the end of it. You've come out with your conclusions, and we've already talked about the kind of political responses from the Prime Minister, actually from civil society as well, calling for the resignation of the IGP and so on. I want to ask you about the family. I mean, you already mentioned Amri Chetmat's wife. There was this rather moving headline that said, "Are we now widows?" What can Suhakam give them? Is there anything that this inquiry gives them as a resource to take their cases further?
At the outset, when we had this panel of inquiry, my own personal thought was that, look, I don't think we are going to have such a breakthrough that we'll be able to trace the whereabouts of these two men when nobody else seems to be to know. But we were trying to gather the information to make some sense of all that had happened. And in that process, we were hoping that we can perhaps arrive at some closure for the families. You see, I think in cases like this, the psychological element has often been overlooked. If you have an accident, somebody gets killed on the road, you see a body there, the family will accept it because there is closure, the person has died. In this case, we just do not know. Their family does not know whether he's dead or alive or wherever he is. So there's no closure in that sense. And yet at the same time, he's not around. So obviously somebody has done something wrong. And the whole idea is to try to see whether these wrongs can be addressed. And I suppose if we can, you know, move in a direction where at the end of it, we have conclusions, we come up with our recommendations, one of which, for example, and if I may put it this way, we should have immediate, short-term, and a little long-term solutions. One is to have immediate appointment of a special task force to reinvestigate, recommence and reinvestigate the whole case.
But this should be happening within the police force.
This is where we have recommended to the Attorney General to appoint special investigators. And obviously, it cannot be people who have been in somehow connected or having any link with the previous investigations.
Was the inquiry itself the result of a feeling or a perception that the police had failed, that there was a dereliction of duty on the part of the police in investigating those cases? Is that why you had the inquiry in the first place?
Well, it resulted from a memorandum that was presented to us, led by Swaram, together with CAGED. These are NGOs doing a fantastic work out there. They came and told us what the problem was. And yes, the feeling was that, look, not enough was being done to try to arrive at the true story. So that's where we thought we could come in. But don't forget, our emphasis is on human rights. Yeah, we are, after all, so how come not so much concerned with the general CID work. We are concerned with infringements, impact on human rights. And when you have somebody who, other than saying Article 5 of our Constitution, right to liberty, right to life, we have to make meaning of this. You know?
Right. In fact, you were saying earlier, you know, when we were talking, you said that you had not experienced or encountered and enforced a disappearance in your, you know, experience as a magistrate and a judge. Do we have the legal framework to deal with enforced disappearance?
We do not. That's why one of our recommendations is that Malaysia should ratify the convention against the enforced disappearance. And then another recommendation is that we should amend our local laws, because right now the laws that govern abductions are in the penal code, and if the abduction results in a demand for ransom, then becomes kidnap under the Kidnapping Act. But there's no provision under a local law to provide for something like this. So we have to look at this international convention, which talks about enforced disappearance. So it's not just disappearance. I hope I'm making my point clear, that it is enforced. And well, if it can be made into as an offence under the local law, that would be a big step forward.
Right. In the minute that we have left, there seem to be people who are, you know, mobilising around the police force, wanting to protect them. And then there are others who are, you know, supporting Suhakam and maybe, you know, civil society voices that are on your side, as it were. This kind of divisive polarisation in terms of the case of Amri Chetmat and Pastor Raymond Koh, is it useful? I mean, how would you like this to proceed? Is it about us against them?
No, absolutely. It's not about us against them. I'm talking about rule of law, I'm talking about justice, and I'm talking about what is right for the family and for the disappeared persons. And I think at the end of the day, the truth will prevail. And if the police have not done anything wrong, please, the burden is on the state to prove this, please come and convince us that there's absolutely nothing wrong on your part. And we'll all be very happy. It's not as though we are out on a witch hunt that we say, oh, you must be responsible. We are not. This is from the evidence we have come to that conclusion. We are fallible. If we are wrong, I'll be the first to admit that we have made mistakes.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Dato Mau Nkwai, Suhakam Commissioner, who led the inquiry into the disappearance of Amuchet Mat and Pastor Raymond Koh, along with Professor Aisha Bidin and Dr. Nick Salida Suhaila, also from Suhakam. This has been Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan, only for Astro 180.